Previously on The Accidental Terrorist.
The year is 1987. Our hero, 19-year-old Mormon elder Bill Shun, has begun a mission for the LDS Church in Canada, gotten homesick for his fiancée, run away, come back again, recommitted himself to missionary work, made a phony bomb threat to keep another missionary from running away, gone to jail, gotten in the newspapers, gone on trial, pled guilty, and served out a one-day sentence. We rejoin the notorious elder shortly after his final release from custody. The Accidental Terrorist, a memoir by William Shun.
Chapter 33.
We thank thee, O God, for a prophet. That's a prophet with an F-I-T at the end. Twilight bloodied the clouds as I returned to the mission office with President Tuttle and my father. President had called ahead, and Elder Snow was waiting there with the apes and a few other missionaries. Snow caught me in a fierce hug as I came through the front door. "You did it, Buck Fart," he said. "Shaz, yeah, you pulled it off." As Snow released me, the sisters rushed up from out of the gloom of the dimly lit entry hall. Sister Roper threw her arms around me, heedless of President's disapproving scowl. I returned her hug perfunctorily and tried to disengage. Not because I wasn't enjoying it, but because I couldn't enjoy it with President and my father and three other elders watching. "I'm so happy for you, Elder Shun," she said. "We've been praying every day." I had to endure hugs from Sister Steed and Sister Herzog next, then McKay and Hardy and Fearing and Bishop and Van Wagner. They milled about me in the entry hall for several minutes more, rehashing the events of the past 3 days, and generally giving vent to their relief. Elder Fearing told us of the dozens of phone calls he had fielded that week, from members and non-members alike, expressing support for me in my plight. Sister Herzog tried to count the number of prayers she'd offered. Elder Van Wagner told us he'd never been worried for a minute. President noticed my father compulsively checking his watch. "Why don't we move things a little further inside?" he suggested. "Give ourselves some breathing room." So the bubbly little crowd relocated to the bullpen, while President herded my father and me toward his office. He cocked an eyebrow toward my father's watch. "You want to get that ticket taken care of, I suppose." My father heaved a martyr's sigh, shoulders hunched. "You all have important work to do," he said. "The longer I'm here, the longer I hold it up." "You're leaving?" I said. The idea filled me with unreasonable grief. "First thing tomorrow," my father said, "assuming there's a flight."
"I'll get on the phone," said President, starting toward his desk.
My father held up a finger.
"I have a question first. I want to ask you about
He nodded in my direction and lowered his voice theatrically.
"His priesthood. The status of it."
President shook his head, nonplussed.
"What do you mean?"
"You know," said my father. "There won't be any repercussions."
President barked the beginning of a laugh, then choked it off.
"Excommunication? Oh my goodness, no."
"Well, you know, in cases like this, with a felony conviction, it used to be..."
"There's nothing to worry about. I haven't got anything like that planned, Brother Shun. Your son here is a fine missionary, and that's how he's going to stay."
He squeezed my shoulder, grinning like a jackal.
"Now why don't I see about that flight for you?"
My father and I stayed again that night in the Tuttle's guest rooms.
"You understand what a lucky young man you are, don't you?"
asked my father, clad only in his garments, as he packed his suitcase in preparation for the morning. I was leaning against the door jamb.
"Yes," I said. "How blessed you are?"
I nodded. He stared at me for a long moment.
"Son, you've had a very sacred experience this week. The Lord preserved you."
Tears sparkled at the corners of his eyes.
"Your Uncle Douglas was standing over you in that courtroom today. He was your guardian angel."
I didn't ask if this was just a feeling, or if my father had actually seen him. My father closed his suitcase, never taking his eyes off me.
Son, this is the kind of experience you don't ever talk about. It's too sacred.
You mean about Uncle Doug? He exhaled noisily.
I mean about everything. All this.
But, I shook my head. It's all over the news. People are going to ask me about it.
Then you tell them it's not something you like to talk about.
But why? It'll sound like I've got something to hide.
You do. You have a criminal record now. It's not the kind of thing you go around bragging about.
He waved a hand, not looking at me.
Now let's say a prayer and get some sleep.
I rode with President Tuttle as he drove my father to the airport early the morning after the sentencing. As my father joined the queue at the customs gate, I looked around for any personnel I might recognize from Monday, but saw no one. The queue, 24 people long, inched forward. Prez and I shuffled along with my father.
I'll let you know when I've transferred that money from savings into checking, my father told me. Then you can pay that fine.
Thanks, I said. It doesn't have to be a full 2,000. With the exchange rate, 1,600 should cover it.
I won't remember that. By the way, I don't think I told you what I heard from your mother on the phone last night. This should interest you too, President.
Oh, what's that? Asked President Tuttle.
She heard this from our stake president, Hank Clearmountain, who also happens to be a pretty high-ranking pilot there at Occidental Airlines. Captain of the fleet, or something like that, it turns out. You remember how they said the whole bomb threat had cost them a total of $2,000?
Of course, said President.
I got the impression that was the reason Judge Feather set the fine the way he did. It struck me as surprisingly low, though, that figure.
That's because it was a little low. My father gestured animatedly, delighting in his opportunity to share some inside dope.
Turns out the figure was really more like $20,000. President Clearmountain convinced the airline to drop a zero when they reported the loss to the authorities.
President Tuttle whistled.
Lucky thing. Very lucky. We both know luck had nothing to do with it, President.
Amen, Brother Shun.
We were nearly at the head of the queue.
And now I'd better shake your hand and wish you a safe flight.
They shook.
Thank you, President. Thank you for everything. I can't tell you what a help you've been.
I'm only doing my job, Brother Shun.
Well, you seem to do it particularly well. Just try to keep my kid out of any more trouble.
President laughed.
Huh, I'll do my best.
My father put a hand on my shoulder and looked into my eyes.
Now you be good. Say your prayers every night, and give thanks to your Heavenly Father for the fact that you're not in jail.
He pointed to President Tuttle.
Obey mission rules, and listen to what this man tells you. He's inspired, I can tell you that.
Don't worry, I said. Almost tentatively, he put his arms around me.
I love you, son, and I'm proud of you. Remember that. And remember what I told you.
He drew his thumb and forefinger across his lips, like a zipper. I'll remember, I said. Then it was his turn at the head of the queue, and he presented his ticket to the customs agent, and President Tuttle and I stepped away, and he was gone. I felt grief and relief in almost equal measure. That evening at 7, I drove over to the local ward meeting house with my two companions. Two, because now that Elder Finn was well and gone, there was an odd number of elders in the mission. Prez had done a lot of shuffling to compensate, and the extra man, a hairy little elder named Zucker, had been sent to join Snow and me. We were now a three-leg. At the time, I didn't see it for the portent it was. The ward potluck dinner had been on the calendar for weeks, but from the reception I got when we walked through the doors, you would have thought it was an impromptu homecoming for the prodigal son. Everyone in the ward was there, and I was mobbed on every side. I shook hands with dozens of people, and dozens more pounded me on the back or tussled my hair. Bishop Tomlinson's Zoftig wife crushed me to her bosom and planted a lipstick mark on my cheek. It took me 15 minutes just to cross the foyer to the cultural hall where dinner was being served. I soaked up the attention like a sponge. The three of us, an intimidating crew to find on one's doorstep, had been tracting all afternoon. We were tired, hungry, and altogether ready for huge mounds of fresh, hot food. As we were getting in line for the serving tables, we ran into the Blanchards. "I'm so sorry I missed dinner the other night," I told them. Sister Blanchard hugged me tightly. "Don't be silly. You're forgiven." "We'll have to make it up to you by dropping in sometime next week," said Snow. "Anytime you want, elders," said Brother Blanchard, pumping my arm. "Come for Sunday dinner." Louisa, looking fragile and beautiful, shook my hand demurely. "We were all praying for you," she said, "and it looks like Heavenly Father heard us." 15-year-old Blaine tugged me by the arm. "Come on, Elder Shun. I brought a couple of non-member friends along tonight, and they're dying to meet the terrorist." "Let the elder get some food first, at least," said Brother Blanchard. "Aw, Dad!" I shrugged. "Hey, I'm a missionary," I said, letting Blaine drag me away. "I can't very well disappoint non-member friends." I did eventually get food, a plate brimming with roast beef, mashed potatoes, gravy, corn on the cob, green bean casserole, jello salad, and more. And balancing it and a glass of red punch in my hands, I went looking for my two companions. The clamor of happy conversation buzzed around me, 200 voices strong, punctuated by the shrieks and laughter of children. I found Snow and Zucker seated near the end of one of the long rows of folding tables set up in the cultural hall, and I was delighted to see that with them sat the Buckinghams. "Hi, everybody," I said, trying to sound casual. Sherilyn squealed when she saw me and jumped to her feet. I managed to set my plate and glass down safely on the table before she got her arms around me. Harold stood up and shook my hand enthusiastically. Little Dorian in his child seat waved his spoon. "We are ecstatic to see you, Elder Shun," said Harold. "We were telling Elder Snow how we wouldn't take another lesson until you were safely out of jail. And now, like a miracle, here you are." "So this means we're picking up again where we left off?" I asked. "Don't be silly, of course." I held up a palm. "I mean, we could go back and start at the beginning if you feel like you need a refresher." "No, Elder," said Harold, shaking his head. "We want to get through the last two lessons as soon as we can. We want to get baptized next week." I couldn't believe the way things were falling into place. After a boisterous ward talent show, two more plates of food, and an embarrassment of desserts, Snow and I stood under the basketball standard at one end of the cultural hall chatting about the bizarre, remarkable week. It had been less than 100 hours since I'd made the bomb threat, but it seemed more like 100 years. We were both stuffed to the gills, and we had just started reminiscing about that merciless meal with the Kent family, when who should wander up but Brother Kent himself. Gaunt, grave, and impeccably dressed, he reached out to shake my hand. "So glad to see you're well, Elder," he said in his cultured, mellifluous voice. "You've had many people here very worried." His grip was warm and dry. "Thank you, Brother Kent," I said. He lowered his eyes briefly. "I understand," he said, with a diffidence that ill befit him, "that you're faced with a rather sizable fine." My mouth went suddenly dry, and alarm bells clanged in my head. I knew what was coming, and I couldn't imagine how to get around it. I nodded. $2,000, I believe," he said. I nodded again, trying not to wince. "Well, some of us here in the ward would like to take up a collection and pay your fine for you." He presented a tentative smile, expecting, no doubt, a prompt and gracious acceptance of his offer. But all I could hear were the words of Judge Feather's sentence. I can't," I stammered. "I can't take any money from you." Brother Kent recoiled. I groped for words that wouldn't come. Elder Snow stepped in smoothly. "What my companion means to say," he purred, taking Brother Kent by the arm like a practiced politician, "is that the judge specifically stipulated this fine must be paid from money he earned himself. Your offer is extremely generous and very much appreciated,
But if Elder Shun lets anyone else pay his fine, he might be in contempt of court. They might try to press more charges against him.
Well, that's terrible, said Brother Kent, absently patting Elder Snow's hand. There must be some way we can help, don't you think?
Snow appeared to give the question serious thought. You know, there just might be, he said. I suppose that once the fine is paid and all legal considerations are out of the way, there'd be nothing to stop a group of gentlemen from making a small contribution to Elder Shun's mission fund, maybe in care of his father.
Brother Kent nodded, mouth just barely curving. I take your point, I do indeed, he said. Thank you, Elder Snow. I'll talk it over with the others. And congratulations once again, Elder Shun. He shook hands with us both and strode away, tall and proud. Snow and I stepped out into the hallway. I needed cold water from a drinking fountain.
I feel like such a slime bag, I said. Thank you, you really saved my bacon there.
Don't worry about it, Buckfart, said Snow. Just remember me when you're rich and famous and you need an agent.
In the end, Brother Kent and his associates donated more than $2,000 to my mission fund.
I ended up making a profit of about $150 Canadian. We baptized Harold and Sherilyn Buckingham on the afternoon of Saturday, March 7th, 8 days after the ward dinner, but it was a bittersweet occasion. Even as I watched their smiling, dripping faces come out of the water, I knew it was one of the last times I would see them. Just that morning, I'd received word that the church planned to transfer me to a mission in the United States. I was told that this was for my own good as a missionary, that I could not be the most effective possible representative of Christ with the infamy I'd accrued in Calgary following me around. I was told this in person by Elder Rex C. Reeve, a member of the church's third highest ruling body, the First Quorum of the 70. Elder Reeve was also administrative head of the church missionary department, and he was in town, by chance, to speak at a local state conference. I was bitterly disappointed by Reeve's news. I told him I loved Calgary and didn't want to leave. I told him I was enjoying my mission for the first time. I urged him to reconsider, but it was a decision with no chance of appeal. It was also a decision that turned out to be prescient. On Tuesday, March 10th, I was summoned to an immigration hearing at a government office building in Calgary. There, an adjudicator determined, after hearing evidence, that my felony conviction warranted the issuance of a departure notice, a more polite version of deportation, but one that left the door open for me to return to Canada years down the road. I wouldn't have been able to stay in the Calgary mission in any case. Snow, Zucker, and I spent the rest of that day and the next dropping in on ward members, investigators, and other missionaries so I could tell them all goodbye. The Buckinghams cried. The Blanchards laid on a farewell feast fit for a king. The sisters hugged me long and hard enough to make me forget I was an engaged man. Thursday morning, Snow and Zucker hauled me and my two cheap suitcases out to the airport. I had expected President Tuttle to accompany us, but apparently he was too busy with the business of running the mission to see me off. I parted ways with Snow and Zucker at the customs gate, where I showed my ticket and surrendered my Canadian work visa. On the far side of the cordon, I was met by the prosecuting agent from my immigration inquiry, a very nice man, who was there to verify my compliance with the departure notice. I waved to my companions, and they stood on tiptoe and waved back over the crowd. Then they were out of sight. The agent accompanied me to my gate. On the way, we ran into my old friend in the orange windbreaker. Black beard bristling, he walked up to me and said, without preamble, "I heard you got off." "I didn't exactly get off," I said, startled. "I went to jail and I paid a fine." He sniffed haughtily and looked away. "So, you're leaving now, eh?" "That's right," I said. "Where to?" "Spokane." "Are you still a missionary?" "Yes," Well, he said, stroking his beard. Then he nodded decisively and walked away.
What was that all about?
Asked the immigration agent. Oh, him. We go way back. Before my flight departed, one other person found me. Darcy Remington, the constable who had arrested me. He shook my hand, congratulated me on my success in court, and offered me his best wishes for the future. This kindness made it all the more difficult for me to board that Occidental airliner and fly away. It was almost as if Canada herself, in the person of a Mountie, were bidding me farewell and good fortune. The pear-shaped man closed his office door behind me and waved me to a chair.
Well, 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 Elder Shun, he said to me,
edging around his desk with the curious sideways motion of a marionette.
You've had quite an ordeal.
He seated himself and bared his teeth at me, no doubt believing it a smile.
It must be good to be back in the USA.
The flight to Spokane, Washington had taken an hour. The Spokane apes had picked me up at the airport and brought me straight here. In another part of this low-rent building, a pack of greenies fresh from the MTC were receiving their orientation. President Ames was taking time out from that for a private conference with me. I sat down in the chair that faced the desk. It was going to be hard to stand up from that chair. It's barely been an hour, I said. The president's smile trembled like a solid reaching its melting point.
Well, yes.
President Ames had a fringe of white hair around his shiny head, another white island on top. The skin of his face was dry, smooth, and papery, with pores like the rind of an orange. His voice was dry and papery, too. He wore thick, plastic-rimmed glasses, and behind them his eyes burned clean and white. The moment stretched. Then his smile bellied full again, puffed by some internal wind of memory.
I spoke to your President Tuttle, he said,
as if this constituted a praiseworthy act.
He tells me we're very fortunate to have you. He says you're eager to put all the unpleasantness behind you and get on with the Lord's work.
The wind slackened, the smile sagged.
He has nothing but praise for you. He recommends you as a leader.
I sat straight in the chair, the only way it would permit. My collar chafed, but I would not loosen my tie. On the wall beside the desk hung a large map covered with pushpins. Next to this, dozens of small photographs were arranged in a grid, smiling young faces grouped by pairs. Bright light filtered into the office through Venetian blinds, without warmth. Leafy branches projected their silhouettes against the blinds. The room smelled faintly of mulch.
Elder Shun, we mean to find you the best possible fit here, somewhere you'll be happy.
The president's hands fluttered blindly on the desktop. Disconnected props.
But we don't want to call undue attention to anything that might distract your fellow missionaries from the work, or hamper your ability to help your investigators feel the spirit.
He leaned forward.
President Tuttle and I both agree that your legal difficulties should stay just between us. No one here needs to know. You can put it behind you now.
I nodded, but inside I was going numb. Put it behind me, as if I should feel ashamed, like I would of a stain on my pants? Sweat stippled my forehead, greased my back. I itched to get out of my suit jacket. The president's pear shape was draped in an expensive gray suit. His jaunty yellow tie was an unfortunate choice. It turned his skin sallow.
I expect that's settled, then, he said with a satisfied nod. Of course, you'll need a cover story. We get transfer missionaries from all over, for all reasons, but no one who... Well...
The smile faltered.
The point is, if your companions ask you why you were transferred here, you need to have something to tell them.
The sound of dry leaves rustling mimicked a laugh.
You can't very well tell them the truth.
Framed portrait prints of Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith gazed down from the walls, from behind glass. I said nothing.
Yes, well.
President Ames snuffled, and his autonomous hands joined in a steeple.
My suggestion is that you use illness as an excuse, in case it comes up, your transfer.
The steeple flexed.
If you're pressed for specifics, you can call it mental illness.
In civilian life, Ames was a pathologist, a disease specialist. Or so the apes told me on the way from the airport. They also told me, Prez is great. He's definitely inspired. I didn't know why he wasn't inspired to suggest a cool disease I could use for my cover.
Well, Elder Shun,
said President Ames, rising. His flesh pooled about his hips. If I pushed him, he might have wobbled, but he wouldn't have fallen down.
Welcome to Spokane. We know you're going to love it here.
Slowly, I rose to shake hands, to press the flesh of the man who would be my spiritual and moral compass for the next 18 months. At least one person had written the Calgary Herald that week to complain not just about the leniency of my sentence, but also the lack of church punishment for my actions. I couldn't dispute the first sentiment, but I had to differ with the second. To me, it felt as if my punishment were just beginning.
Next time on The Accidental Terrorist.
In our next installment, All's Well That Ends, ironically. Or is it? Will Bill last out the remaining 18 months of his mission? Will Katrina really wait for him? Will this story end in happy matrimony? Does knowing Bill's wife is named Laura undercut that question's suspense? What's so significant about an old man behind the counter of a Manhattan deli? And at long last, we tackle the most compelling question of all. What about Bob? The undergarment sundering answers.
Just 1 week from now!
The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2007-2009, by William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.